Welcome to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. Slightly later than usual, it's a Wednesday morning. This is going out. I hope everyone hasn't missed us too much from Monday. But how are you, Jermaine? How's it going?
Well. I'm good. Obviously, busy, work.
You're off. By the time people have this in their ears, you'll be on the slopes enjoying
snowboarding.
Where are you going?
In France. Obviously, I'm trying not to break my arm like I did last time. So we'll see. And I've got to save my legs if I to keep the smackdown up.
Exactly, yeah. You've got to be ready for this half marathon in a few months. So, yeah, don't do too wild. Don't go off-piste. I literally know nothing about skiing. Like, I've never been. I don't know how to do it. So my wife's really keen to get us out there with my little baby this winter. But, I'm going to be strictly sitting inside the chalet.
Surely she's too small to go.
Well, the baby? No, I'll stay inside with her, and then she'll go out snowboarding, yeah. But apparently Kylian Jornet, I remember that interview we did with him a while back, he said he was skiing at the age of 11 months. So you get him in there early, get him going, and then you never know, she might be an ultramarathon star of the world if she does that. But anyway, we'll see.
You never know.
You never know.
So what's been happening? Any stories?
Any stories? We'll leave it till later on, but I ran 10K. In a race, got absolutely hammered by this one fella. I thought, you know, when you look at someone, you think, I think he's a runner because he's got really tiny hips. Do you know what I mean? He's got a really tiny hip. He's so like lean.
That's a terrible analysis.
But he was. I thought. I looked at him. And I thought. I don't know. I've never seen him because I know people in the Dutch scene now. And I thought, I don't know him, but he's got really tiny hips, so probably might be good. And he slammed it. I think the first K he ran like 2:50, and I was like, oh my God, I'm not going to try and live with this guy. So he carried that on. I thought he was going to die, but he didn't. He absolutely smashed me. He did 29:50, and I was 2 or 3 minutes back from that. But we'll talk about our 10Ks later on, so we'll address that later. But you're also looking forward to a week off work?
I am, but obviously antics whilst I'm at work.
Yeah.
So, you remember I was telling you about that camera on the top deck?
Yeah.
And if you sit at the front, obviously, the driver can see everything.
Yeah.
So, this fairly good-looking woman gets on. She must have been, like, 40, maybe. Yeah. And she gets on, sits right at the front. I'm like, okay. And this young sort of model-looking guy, he's super good-looking, yeah? He's, like, hair slicked back.
Yeah.
And he goes up the I watch him. He goes up the stairs. And all the top deck's empty. He looks around and he sees this woman at the front.
Yeah.
And he goes and sits right at the front on the other side of the bus. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously, I'm driving along, but I watch it at the same time. It's super funny. It's like a soap opera. And he's looking over at her, but she's not paying attention because she's on her mobile phone.
Yeah.
And then he takes his jacket off and he's like flexing his muscles. And then I'm thinking, this guy. Yeah. And then he's leaning forward, he's trying to catch her eye.
Yeah.
So he's leaning forward, you know, like he's like playing, moving his arms and stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously I stop, pick people up. Next to you, I look up, he's talking to her.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But she's sort of facing forward, so like she's semi-interested.
Yeah.
Right. So obviously I'm carrying on driving. Yeah. And I look up again, and then now she was swiveled towards him, and obviously they're facing each other, and they were laughing and choking. And I was like, "Boy, I better get my notepad out. This guy is good, you know." And then I was thinking, he's got to ask for a number soon. And I'm like halfway through the journey now, so it's been like 40 minutes. I was thinking, someone's getting off in a minute. I was thinking, he needs to get a number.
And what happened? Don't leave us in suspense.
So I come into Canada Water, and that's a big stop. So yeah. I'm opening the doors, but I'm looking at the camera, and he gets up and he waves by, but he doesn't get a number. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God.
So when you're on the buses of London, when Jermaine's a driver, you might think he's concentrating on the road ahead, but really, he's watching the stories unfold.
I'm watching your business. That's what I'm doing. Watching your business.
The snooping bus driver, Jermaine. <Met. laughs> Watch out, everybody. Watch out.
I thought it was funny.
Well, this week, we're really lucky. The reason why we are releasing this slightly late is because we've got a really exciting interview on this week's show. a lot of you've seen over the last couple of weeks has been various news stories about Jasmine Paris. Now, she won something called the Montane Spine Race, which is running along the Pennine Way, I think, at 268 miles. And she was one of only, I think, 11 women that entered the race. And she won, and she broke the record by 12 hours. I think she beat her nearest competitor by 15 hours. She absolutely smashed it. All the while, she was expressing milk for her baby daughter on checkpoints. It's incredible achievement. Like, I saw something in The Guardian about how it was on par with Bannister and all this sort of thing. So people are going absolutely mad for Jasmine. And she, you know, it's incredible race for her. So we're going to talk to her about her achievement and what it felt like running out there for 268 miles. We can't really relate, Jim. What's the furthest you've run personally or exercised like before?
The furthest I've run is probably hour and a half, yeah. But the longest I've exercised, I've done. I get to 1 hour and 15, and my legs fall apart. Yeah. So,
Jasmine did 83 hours. 83 hours she was out there. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. She's got me on lockdown. Yeah. She's got me on lockdown. I did do the rides 100, so 100 miles. Out to Surrey and back into London.
Oh yeah, yeah.
How and was that? That was brutal. Yeah. Obviously, me being me, I'm thinking I'm fit. Oh yeah. And then I was with Andy Rayner, but there was a group of us, and we had a plan. Like, they had stopwatches. We take drinks every like 10 minutes and stuff. You know, like take the lead. Everyone takes the wind.
Yeah.
And then they kept stopping for a wee. It was annoying. And I was thinking, I saw women go past, and I was like, oh no, I'm gonna get chicked. So I left them, and obviously just bombed it.
Yeah.
And then by halfway, I blew up and it was just messy. I just, so yeah, certain things, yeah, it doesn't matter what gender you are, you just can't. If you're not good enough, you're not good enough.
Exactly, yeah. And it's funny because like, being chicked is a thing, I think. Like people, like you are worried. I remember when I did my first marathon and I was upset that I got chicked. People do, as athletes, you do, that does make a consideration for you. Do you know what I mean? But as they go longer,
I think only if, I can't say if you take it seriously, but if, you know, like if you're a semi-pro or slash pro runner,
yeah,
you've always, I won't say a chip on your shoulder, but you think, oh, only certain men can beat me, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, but the longer you go, it looks like, the longer it goes, the more likely these, you know, the gender divide gets smaller sort of thing. So they, I don't know, there's not really been many studies into it, but there's a, I think it's a lady, is it Courtney DeVolta, ultra runner over in America. She's winning loads of races and she's you know, making a big mark. And Nikki Spinks is someone over here who's winning headlines and for her incredible ultra achievements. And obviously Jasmine, who we're going to speak to in a sec, is doing similar. But
what about you? What's the longest you've tried to?
Do you know, I think I've probably only just done over a marathon. I'm trying to think about that. I've always thought, because I can run, I think, oh yeah, I'll do some ultra someday and I'll be fine at it. And it'll be, because you have a little bit of a chip on your shoulder about ultra. You think, oh yeah, it's easy. Like if you can run in at 5K, 10K is harder than, you know, running for 6 hours. I can do that, no trouble. But I reckon I would come an absolute cropper if I tried to run more than, I'd come a cropper on a marathon, let's be honest. So yeah, any further than that's probably going to kill me.
Are you? And like, if you ain't seen Sean, he looks like a cropper when he does short distance because he's not the smoothest runner.
No, I was going to try and defend myself then, but I can't. Yeah, I do look pretty weak.
You're the fastest shuffler in Holland at the moment. Yeah,
yeah, well, maybe not after this weekend when I got hammered. But anyway, but let's listen to Jasmine. Let's talk about her race and let's see how she coped with that distance and what her plans are for the future. Here she is. In this week's show, we're talking to Jasmine Paris. How are you doing, Jasmine?
Yeah, I'm great, thank you. Yeah.
And you just obviously last week finished. Was it last week you finished the race, the spine race?
Yeah, so I think it's now 2 weeks since I finished. Yeah, pretty much dead on 2 weeks. Wow. Yeah.
And just the hearing the length of it and what you guys had to go through. Why did you do it? What like motivated you to do that challenge?
What possessed me? Yeah. Yeah, so it's funny because it was actually a race that I always said I would never do. We've always raced there's a local race that runs in the opposite direction on the same day, and every year I saw the spine runners looking incredibly miserable already, only sort of 20 miles into the race, less than that. So I always said I would, it's a crazy race, and who would ever sign up for that? But yeah, I did it because I think I sort of needed motivation in sort of autumn time. I realized that I just needed some motivation to get up and train. I was finding it harder and harder because I was not getting very much sleep. So I was finding it hard to get up and train. And I just needed a big goal to motivate me. And the Spine, actually, much as I'd always said it was a crazy race, it also was kind of different than anything I'd ever done. And I sort of, there's something about doing a challenge when you're not really quite sure how it'll go, or, you know, if it's so totally different than anything you've ever done, you don't really know how you're going to cope with it. So all of those things kind of came together, and that's how I entered.
And were you sort of prepared for the depths of winter, the temperatures you had to go through, and that sort of thing? Were you, did you take that into account when you signed up? Did you like realize the depths of the
yeah, I think, I mean, I think that, as I said, kind of because of having always raced the race in the opposite direction, it's a local race in the opposite direction on the same day. I remember one year when we were sort of up to our knees in slush on that race, and I only raced for 5 hours, and at the end of it I thought, oh thank goodness I don't have to, you know, I don't have to spend any more time outside in that weather. So I think I was well aware of how bad it could potentially get. So that was something I was aware of, I guess. We were actually pretty lucky. I mean, it was wet and windy, but there was very little snow.
Yeah, and you were out for 83 hours, is that right?
Yeah.
And which, is it right you only slept for 7 of those?
Less than that, actually. I probably slept for about 3 hours in total.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
How did you plan it? Did you plan to take regular sleep intervals? Do you kind of come up with a plan on the hoof?
A bit of both, really. I think generally none of the leaders, I think, would sleep the first night, because the checkpoint that you get to, you'd probably get there about 5 o'clock in the evening. Mm. It's very unlikely you'd actually be able to sleep at that point anyway. Mm. So most people just run through the first checkpoint, and that means that you sort of run through the first night. And that was always in my plan. Mm. And then on the second night, I slept for about 2.25 hours. I had planned to sleep for a bit longer, but various things came together. It's very difficult in that race context, especially if you're sort of neck and neck with someone. If they get up, then it was difficult. I heard them being woken up and I couldn't really stay asleep anymore. And then the third night I had planned to sleep, but then I was sort of 2 hours ahead of the person that was chasing me, and I really didn't want them to catch me in the checkpoint. I felt that was the make or break point, really. So I just had a little doze and I made myself leave the checkpoint, so I wasn't there when he arrived.
And how did you cope with the sleep deprivation? Was that tough?
Yeah, I think I've there's quite a lot of people have sort of asked about that, and well, I guess the baby helped. So my daughter is 14 months, and she certainly wasn't sleeping through the night before the Spine. She was getting up, she was waking me up sometimes every 2 hours during the night. So that definitely helped. Yeah. And also, I think I've never really needed to sleep that much. I've sort of always got by on less sleep than most people. So probably those two things came together.
Yeah, and I've heard something about how you were hallucinating at one stage. Do you think that was anything to do with the lack of sleep you're having?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was, I'm sure that was pretty much totally sleep, you know, lack of sleep. Yeah. Was the cause of that. Probably a bit of physical tiredness as well, but mainly lack of sleep. Yeah. And it, you know, it was sort of hallucinating. You're sort of aware that that's not really what you were seeing, you know, that you were, I was aware that I was hallucinating, that these weren't real things. Yeah. And in some ways they were kind of diverting and interesting to take my mind off what was going on.
Just go with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And looking at sort of your tactics in terms of planning, did you have any other tactics in terms of, did you plan out how this is going to go, how are you going to attack this race in advance, or did it go how you planned, in a way?
I'm trying to think. Yeah, so I guess the sleep thing, that kind of was my main, to be honest, before the race I thought to myself that if you could run at 4 miles an hour, you could sleep quite a lot and still sort of win it based on previous record winners' times. And but what I was, realistically, when you're on the ground running at 4 miles an hour is pretty much, you know, maybe somebody could do it, but you realize that that's actually a much bigger ask than you imagined. So really what happened was I ran slower than that, often nearer 3 miles an hour, but I slept less. So I ended up actually finishing around the same sort of time that I imagined might be possible if you were sort of moving at that speed. So, but as I said, I slept quite a lot less than I had actually planned.
Yeah. And then was that the goal then, when the goal was to go out there and take the victory? And take the course record?
It's an interesting thing. So I think the thing with the course record is it's massively dependent on the weather conditions. And I'll be the first one to say that we had really favorable conditions. So, you know, in another year, I'm sure I would be much slower. So that's the first thing to say. And you know, I guess I went out with this sort of idea. I thought I could be competitive at the front of the field, I went out wanting a race. So when we were actually racing with you, when we were running neck and neck with Eugenie at one point, I sort of got the impression that he was treating it very much as a team effort. And whilst I really enjoy friendship and on the hills and everything else, but I had come to race this as a race. So I was kind of glad when it turned into a bit more of a race and it was a bit more open and clear that we were actually racing, because I was a bit nervous that it was going to get to the end and we were going to kind of be in this awkward situation of what happens now.
When did that happen?
Well, I think at checkpoint 4, he stopped for longer. He had some issues with his feet and his legs, and he had massage and some blister treatment. So we both ate there. I expressed some milk, and then I was essentially ready to go again. And he was having some various things done, and he was asleep. So at that point, I left the checkpoint. And so I think he slept for about 45 minutes there, and I didn't sleep at all. And then that opened a gap, basically. And then it was quite exciting, because after that we were sort of, for the next few hours, it was clear that he was trying to catch me up and I was trying to get away. And we had various people reporting back to us on what the split was. Yeah. And obviously in a race like that, so long that you're not actually moving that fast, but it felt more like a race at that point. I mean, I was definitely trying to get away as quickly as I could, and he was trying to catch me as quickly as he could. So it was kind of exciting, and yeah, that was an interesting point. That was quite fun.
Yeah. And what was the terrain like out there? Was it, obviously you said it wasn't too bad in terms of it wasn't too wet and it was fairly dry, but was it quite a challenging race
Yeah, it's kind of a mixture of terrain. So there's obviously the Pennine Way has some sections which are pretty wild, like this last section over the Cheviots it feels really quite remote. And obviously there's a section the first section over Bleaklow and Kinderscow and so on, and then the section over Penny Ghent and so on. But then there's also other sections where you're going through lots of farmers' fields and farmyards and actually I find those sections, if anything, the most challenging, because trying to find your way through those fields is actually really difficult. And it's the sort of sections that aren't really walked very much by people, unless I guess they're planning to do the whole Pennine Way. So if people are only doing little bits and they pick and choose the sort of most scenic bits, and they often won't go through all those farmyardy farmland sections. So basically the path is very difficult to find. So that's why it was really useful that we were all forced, you know, we were asked to, made to carry, as part of the mandatory equipment, you had to carry a GPS with a route on it. And actually, I found that really useful for those nighttime sections through the farmlands.
Yeah. And like I was going to say, how did you train specifically for this race? So did you have to do any getting out on rough terrain with in the dark and with a head torch and stuff? Did you train specifically for this event and the terrain and the type of challenge you were going to encounter?
I don't like, so I'm a fell runner, and in winter, you essentially, if you want to carry on running in winter, then you run in the dark, so with a head torch. And I run on the hills every time I run, so I don't really feel like I had to train for the terrain and the darkness or anything. I did change my training, so I definitely trained more. I actually enlisted the help of a friend to coach me who does some coaching. I also massively increased my mileage and did a lot of training runs with a full pack. So those were the kind of main things I actually trained differently for the spine. But in terms of terrain and darkness, those were things I don't really feel like I had to train, because that's just my background.
Yeah. Okay. For me, the marathon is as far as I go. And even on the marathon, I struggle with concentration and keeping my head focused on what I'm doing. What did you think about for the race? Can you remember much of the race now, looking back?
Yeah, I can remember a lot of it, I think. Like, it's, you know, obviously with ultra stuff, I think that's part of the reason I like ultra stuff, is that you don't have to remain quite as intently focused, and you couldn't remain like that for 83 hours, you know. So I thought of lots of different things. I thought of my family. I thought of when I was struggling, I thought about my little girl. I distracted myself with thinking about what she might be doing and the funny things that she does that make me smile. Then, to be honest, on the last day, you were sort of alluding to the fact that you struggled to concentrate during a marathon. But on the last day, and I was in the Cheviots where I was so tired, I almost kept forgetting what I was actually doing there. Like, I think I was having these micro sleeps, and every time I came to, I would for a second not really know where I was or what I was doing. And then I would remember that I was supposed to be doing the Pennine Way. And then I'd remember that it was a race. And then I'd suddenly panic and wonder whether I'd actually been on the Pennine Way. Yeah. So I'd kind of, and that kept repeating itself over and over again during that day. So, you know, talking about a race focus, there was very little race focus on that last day.
Yeah. And was there sort of, you said physically or mentally had dark moments. When did that happen?
Surprisingly enough, probably the first night was the hardest for me, just you know, because I had the furthest to go. I felt the separation from my daughter most keenly, I think, on that first night. After that, I was more race focused. Well, I was more involved in the race after that, I think. The first night I was still fresh enough to sort of, feel the difference. And also sort of, it was so far to go to get home still. Mm. So that's kind of when I struggled most mentally, I think, really. Mm. And towards the end, when I got tiredest, it was really a race then, you know, with Eugenie chasing me. And I think there was quite a lot of adrenaline flowing at that point. So that kind of helped carry me forward.
Yeah. And what did it feel like crossing the line? What did it mean to you to win the race?
I was really delighted. I was really delighted to win, and it was a fantastic feeling. I guess I knew during that last day, that whole last day of the Chile, I sort of knew that if I just kept going, and I should be able to win it. If you see what I mean by then, I think he would have had to do something pretty special to close the gap at that point. But nevertheless, it was an amazing feeling. But I think the nicest thing was just getting back to the, you know, to my family and getting back to my daughter and, you know, and seeing everybody again. So that was kind of,
And it was such a massive record. Like, and you basically destroyed the field pretty much. I think the next person in within 15 hours, is that right, behind you? And then 12 hours.
Although Eugenie obviously would have been much closer if he hadn't unfortunately, you know, collapsed with hypothermia so close to the finish. So I was really sad about that. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. The next person to finish was about 15 hours behind.
Why do you think you were able to do that?
I think I've always been, you know, I guess I'm probably the sleep deprivation training helped. I think I've always just been quite, I guess, good at sort of endurance type events. You know, I don't know why. I think it's just one of those things. I've just, you know, so that it probably just, I didn't really expect to be able to sort of be so far ahead of the other people behind me. So I was a bit surprised myself, really. I can't quite explain how it happened, to be honest.
And we're seeing a lot of women, well, let's say outperforming men in ultra distance events. And it's like, and sometimes they talk about it's linked to mental strength. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I guess my only thoughts would be that I think it's true that once you go to longer distances, the sort of the gap between men and women closes. Yeah, that's all I can say. It's obvious that in short distances, if you get good men and good women, there is a physiological difference and the women can't beat the men. But if you go to longer distances, then I think it's much more of an even playing field. And whether it's mental, I don't know. I do think that to some extent that women don't tend to enter. There's obviously it's interesting because there's actually a much smaller number of women in these events than men. There's still a massively, the ratio must have still been 8 or 9 to 1 on the spine in terms of men to women. And that's interesting if we are speculating that perhaps women are, you know, potentially as good as or even sometimes better than men at these long distance events. And what I wonder is whether potentially sometimes women are less likely to enter these events unless they feel pretty confident with the training they've done and the preparation they've done. Yeah. I just remember the Dragon's Back, which was another long race I did, which was stage race. I remember being told there that sort of 90% of the women that enter will finish and only 50% of the men that enter will finish based on previous years' statistics, which would suggest
That's quite stark, isn't it, really?
The women are better prepared than the men when they do actually enter, but I don't know. I'm really speculating. I don't have any evidence, so yeah. I don't want to offend any parties at all.
I mean, perhaps your accomplishments, and yours and Nikki and is it Courtney DeVolta? Is that her name? The US ultra runner?
Yeah.
And maybe your accomplishments will persuade more people, women, to give it a crack and to enter these ultra races, even if they're perhaps unprepared to.
Yeah, maybe. And whether they enter ultra races or whether they just go out for a run in the hills, I don't think you have to run the spine, you know, like I don't think everybody needs to be inspired to run the spine, because it is quite a, you know, it's a relatively extreme end of the spectrum. But if people are inspired to just get out and you know, and maybe, you know, go for a run with the local Fell Runners Club, or just, you know, try that half marathon that they were thinking about entering, you know, then that's probably a really positive thing. And if people realize, there's been a lot of discussion in terms of the breastfeeding and the baby as well, and also lots of, like, a really pleasingly, lots of young people have been in touch, lots of children that were following the race. And that's kind of like, I'm really excited by the idea that I might have inspired, you know, them as well, and young girls, because I know there's lots of, there's sort of a question of how often is a higher dropout rate, I think, in terms of sport in young girls. So, like, the thought that I might have inspired those people is really what makes me most excited about the whole sort of media and the coverage and everything that there has been since the race. That's kind of the most rewarding thought for me, is that, really.
Yeah. And well, my wife, lying next door, she's breastfeeding at the moment. We have an 8-week-old daughter. She couldn't believe you were able to, you know, to breastfeed and to train and to be a mother and yet still be able to do all the things you're doing. Like, how has breastfeeding specifically, has that affected your training at all when you've come back?
I think that probably the breastfeeding sort of is a little bit more of a challenge in the early days, obviously. So I think most, you know, generally, I think the advice is that they just have milk till 6 months. So during that period when they're entirely dependent on you for milk, assuming you're breastfeeding, then it's a little bit more challenging. And at the start, I had to work around feed times in terms of going for runs. And obviously you couldn't stay out too long because then you'd start to get uncomfortable. Now it's quite easy because now she eats everything. She eats lots, you know, she doesn't really need me anymore. It's more of a comfort thing now, really. Breastfeeding.
Was it the intention to breastfeed it or to express running?
It wasn't. No, she was supposed to be weaned really before the race. I assured Damien, who coaches me, that she would be weaned before the race. Not that he was pushing for that at all, but it was very much what I assumed would be the case. But she got a bit poorly over Christmas, and then she sort of went right back onto breastfeeding, and I just didn't manage it in time, and I didn't want to do it forcibly at all. And actually it worked out fine, because she was perfectly happy when I wasn't there. She wasn't bothered at all. And now she's actually sleeping much better at night, since I think she's sort of broken that cycle of feeding at night quite so much. So it's all been really positive, actually.
Yeah. One of the hidden benefits of doing a 83-hour race. Yeah.
So if you're trying to night wean your baby, all you need to do is run 268 miles, and when you come home, they'll be much easier. Yeah.
And obviously, look, motherhood affects your body, affects you mentally and physically. Have you noticed any changes? I guess that's quite a broad question, but what changes have you noticed? And is your focus changed? And how do you think motherhood's affected you as an athlete?
Well, I think one of the lovely things for me about running is that it sort of is still my thing. You know, I think it's really, really important for, I think this might be another thing that, you know, for young mums to take note of, is that it's really good to keep something that that is for you in a way. And it's not selfish. It's just that you need to sort of safeguard a little bit of what I feel like this is kind of my thing, the running thing. It gives me a bit of headspace, gives me a chance to get out into the hills, and it makes me happy. And I think that if I can sort of maintain a little bit of that and maintain a sense of me, then it also make me a better mum, and hopefully also inspire my daughter grows up. So I think that's kind of one of the wonderful things about running since I had my daughter, is that it's actually become a kind of a really precious me time, if you see what I mean. Because I love being a mum. This is a different, and most of the time, as I say, I am a mum, and that's kind of my sole focus. But when I go running, that's a little bit of time for me.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
And so, and because obviously, then there's the obvious things. Time is more precious, so I'm probably more focused when I train. I try and train more efficiently, and when I was on the spine, if it was hard at times, then you kind of say to yourself, well, think of all the times that you've sort of got up early in the morning and sacrificed spending that morning cuddling in bed, you know, then you kind of really want to make it worthwhile as well when it actually comes to the crunch and you're in that race situation.
And I know Paula Radcliffe as well, I think she broke the world record post the birth of her child. Do you think physically you've become any stronger, or is it difficult to say?
It's interesting because I think from what I understand, there's certainly some evidence that stamina improves after having a baby. I don't know about speed. Like, I think quite often speed suffers a little bit, at least at first maybe, but then stamina's pretty good. I can't say at the moment I've noticed a massive difference. Basically, I feel that it's only really in the last month or two that I've actually got back to where I was before having my daughter. So I can't really say that I've done a lot of racing to be able to compare previous times and times now. So I guess I'll have to just race this season and see how I feel compared with before. But I'm pretty sort of I think this has been a really good boost for my confidence, the whole spine thing, because I sort of feel like I'm back and competitive again, and that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, and obviously you've been selected to run for Great Britain at the IAU Trails coming up.
So that's really exciting. Yeah,
very exciting. So you're a very high achiever. Like you've represented Great Britain. I think you've the number of British fell running champion. You were sixth at UTMB in 2016. Is that right?
Yeah.
And did you get a bronze at the Sky Running World Championships too? And you're the record holder of the world. I guess it is the world record for the female Bob Graham round. Is that right? You're obviously, you're doing your thesis for a PhD you're studying, and you're a vet at the moment. You're obviously a high achiever. You're obviously a high achiever. Do you think that was instilled in you as a child? Were you always someone who was pushing the boundaries and trying to achieve big?
I don't know. That's quite a hard question. I guess I had an upbringing where I sort of believed I could do anything. I guess my parents gave me the confidence to believe that I could do anything I wanted to do. So that's probably a really precious gift to give a child. And also, I've been asked lots of time about the sort of female male thing. I do think that my parents treated me no differently to my brothers, and very much I grew up thinking I just genuinely didn't think about the fact that a woman being a woman would in any way disadvantage me. It seemed like a completely even, from my point of view, it seemed like an even lot, whether you're a man or a woman. So, I think that's a really wonderful kind of way to be brought up. So I think that probably helped in terms of my aspirations in life, and sort of where I went from there. And I've probably always been competitive, but I was never, like, as a child, I wasn't like the sporting superhero in the class or anything like that. I really wasn't, we did cross-country races at school and stuff, and I wasn't the one winning those races. So, for any kids that might listen out there or whatever, I don't think I was like a sporting superstar when I was a child. I was kind of like active, I wasn't sitting on the sofa, but equally I don't think I was anybody probably would have thought I was going to do anything amazing in terms of sport.
Oh, so when did the fell running start then? So what was your first fell race?
When I left university, I was working as a vet in Glossop, and my colleague Richard suggested I go along to a local fell race, and then I went, and I really loved it. Yeah, so I thought this is kind of what I want to do. I remember, sort of, it was this moment of enlightenment, of this revelation that people were running around in the hills and doing this for fun, and I thought, this is amazing. So, and then I realized very quickly that the community was also amazing, like really lovely people. That's when I started.
And the move to Ultra was a natural progression from that. You just enjoyed being out in the hill.
Yeah, and I think just the longer races meant that you could stay out in the hills longer. So, and also it's not as kind of a rushed affair, is it? If you're running an ultra, you can chat to people and you can eat cake and
yeah,
that sort of thing, you know. And you don't travel like halfway across the country for like a 5 mile stampede up a hill. So yeah, I'm definitely more of an ultra person.
Yeah, and obviously with the, we mentioned the Britain team. Have you got any other goals or aims over the next few years that you want to, or things you want to achieve in the next couple of years with your running?
I mean, I've got loads of races that I'm keen to do and loads of non-racing stuff that I'm excited about, challenges like in the UK and abroad as well. And the more I do, the more like people say, oh, what have you looked at that? And, or do you want to come and race this race? And it's like, it's a really wonderful feeling. It's a wonderful situation to be in. So yeah, I've got lots of things that I, this year we're doing, I'm running the PTL with my husband at the end of the summer as well, which is the Petit Trot de Lyon, which is the long kind of race in the UTMB series. So we're running that as a team, and that's another non-stop race. That'll be fun as well. But my husband's not quite as good as me, I think, at not sleeping. So yeah, he's already told me that we have to get more sleep than I had during the spine. So should be a breeze, that one.
So you've got to practice some more sleeping then. That's the training goal over the next few months.
Or he's got to have some sleep deprivation.
Okay, yeah, the other way around.
That's the way around we should do it, really. Yeah.
Excellent. And I've got three final questions to go before you. They're quick fire questions we ask all our interviews. And they are, if you could be anywhere running now, where would it be?
I think probably Jura, and it's an island off the west coast of Scotland. It's a really special place for us. It's where we got married, and there's a Fell race there every year. So that's it's a pretty special place.
Okay, and they make whiskey there, right? I think
make whiskey. Yeah.
Nice. And the second question is can you recommend our listeners something? So it could be anything you like. It can be something physical, like a book or a film, or it could be do a particular race you think is incredible, or go somewhere. It's anything you can think off the top of your head you'd like to recommend someone do to enrich their lives. It's a tough question.
Enrich their lives. Yeah. I would say, I mean, I think the most fun times are when you could get a group of friends together and go on a long day out in the mountains, whether that's walking or running. So I would just say, kind of be spontaneous and, you know, go out and get with a group of friends and go to some bigger mountains and enjoy it. Yeah,
sounds great. And our final question is, if what do you think, in your opinion, is the greatest endurance performance of all time? So one-off performance by anyone that's inspired you.
You know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to put it into a single performance. That's quite hard to do.
You can have more than one, or a character that has inspired you particularly is fine.
So it kind of, in recent years, a friend, actually a fellow fell runner that we know reasonably well, he's a lovely chap called Steve Birkinshaw, broke the Wainwright's record in the Lake District. So he ran all the Wainwright's hills, and that was a pretty hard ask. It was a good record before he started, and I saw what he put himself through to do that, and how broken he was at the end. So I think that was a pretty phenomenal achievement, and that's the sort of thing that probably has mainly stayed within fell running circles. But that was a pretty big achievement. So fantastic. I'll just say that one. But if I had a long time, I'd probably come up with a huge list, but that's kind of sat in my brain at the moment.
Yeah, one's good enough. Perfect. Well, good luck for the IAU, and it's Rowan, isn't it, your daughter?
She's called Rowan. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And hope you and the family are well for the next few years, and everything goes well. Great, and hopefully we'll see you breaking more records out on the hills again soon.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
So great interview there, Jasmine. Nice of her to give us some time away from her PhD, her thesis, to speak to us on Let's Get Running. Thanks for that, Jasmine. But Jermaine, well, let's talk about our running. Not your running. Let's talk about our running. Yeah, our running.
Let's talk SmackDown.
Let's talk SmackDown, yeah. So it's not long to go. We're both in the race at the big half, which is going to be fun. We're going to enjoy that. We will put some details about that on the show notes for this week's show if you want to get involved and be a part of that. So we're going to get ourselves ready. Are you a trainer? You've now joined Strava. You're part of the Strava Revolution. How was that?
Messy.
Messy, yeah. I see you had a couple of cracks at the 10K. trying to run that?
Well, yeah, because obviously I don't run with my phone.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, let me just, so I just obviously ran back from work and I just stuck it in my backpack. So the first one was like 8.5K. So I was thinking, I need to bolt on a bit more. So I did an extra, I did a loop of Hyde Park and then I ended up doing 12.5K. So,
but still, technically, you run 10K. So if anyone hasn't heard last week's episode with Wendy Sly, we launched a 10K challenge, a 10K duel. If you want to take part, get on and do it. Try out Wendy's and listen to her advice on there and come up and try and run a 10K and then try and see if you can improve that over time.
So my 10K, I must have been like 44 minutes or something, 40.
Yeah.
It's going to be 40s.
Right, if we take, let's get rid of some of these Ks. So your first couple of Ks, the first one was 441. You're just getting into it. Just getting into it. And then
no, I was going over Waterloo Bridge in pesky blimmin' pedestrians in my way.
So let's take it then. We'll ignore the first two Ks and we'll take it from there, yeah? So take off. Oh.
Well, first 2K, look, I go over Waterloo Bridge and yeah. Down the Strand.
Okay, so ignore those. and then you're going, right, you did 410, 425, 416, 410, 4 minute K.
That's all around Hyde Park. And bang. Then obviously, if you go around the back of Hyde Park, you know, it's all downhill. So that's probably that bit.
So that was your best, your pace, 4 minute Ks you hit on K8 of your run last night. We'll work out exactly what that is if we take the first two Ks off and give you a time. So that was pretty good, though, Jermaine.
I'm with the civilians here. Yeah. I'm with the civilians, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. How was it? Were you gassing?
I was blowing hard. But if I can do 75, yeah. That's my target.
Yeah.
I'd be happy with that.
Yeah.
I think, but I'm going to try and wing it though.
Yeah. I reckon you're going to need to put a bit of work in to get 75.
Because I was trying to work it out. Because you think about it, obviously, if I was racing the 10K, if you want, you're running a pair of 37s for 10K.
Is that all it is? Okay.
Well, you think that's what, 74? Because it's almost two 10Ks, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Well, it's more than two 10Ks. It's 21K, isn't it?
Is it 21K?
Yeah.
Well, it's 1K, 1.5K more then.
Okay, yeah. 21.1K. So,
yeah,
a couple of 35, 36s. Do you reckon you can manage?
Well, that'd be way quicker. Yeah. If I did that.
Listen, it's your first go. You're wearing a backpack. He was on a course where loads of other people were running around. You're crossing roads. Don't worry about it.
I don't want sympathy vote. Hey, I'm just doing it for the team.
Yes. Well, I got smashed. Got my ass on 10K, ran 10K in Vondelpark in a race for my club. And the first K, the guy went off in 2:50. And I thought, you're coming back to me, mate. At some stage, you'll come back to me. And he never did. 29:50. And it's interesting, right? Those who have been
29:50, that's solid on your own.
Yeah, for him, he was absolutely, and you're mostly and like you said, slalom round. If you got he was quick, yeah.
And like you said, if you got really thin hips, that must be hard work.
Yeah, he weighs next to nothing, and he's slammed it. But he was good. He was really good, and I ran 32:36. And I went wrong once. So, like, obviously, where I was wearing my local vest, Vanos, Amsterdam, and there was three races in one. So there's a 3.5K, a 6.5K, and a 10K. So basically, you did one lap, two laps, or three laps. And I went around the first lap, and this guy was racing me. And I was thinking, why is this guy racing me? You got another two laps to go. Like, the other guy had run away, but I was thinking, why is this other guy trying to chase me down? And literally, I realized I didn't realize there was only one race, that there was three races. So he turned off. And I turned to follow him because I thought, oh, he's gone a different way. I'll follow him. And then everyone started shouting at me, but they were shouting at me in Dutch, so I didn't know what the hell they were saying because obviously they thought I was like, Dutch because I was wearing the fat vest. So I had to stop and I was like,
running with your phone, use Google Translate.
I had to stop and say, sorry, everybody, I can't speak English. Have I gone the wrong way? Like, yes, I have.
I can't speak English.
I can't speak Dutch. Yeah, have I gone the wrong way? So that took an extra 10, 15 seconds. So if I was down low 32. So I'm not in bad shape. And I'll get better. And it's funny, like, if you've been in shape, I'm sure you agree with this. Like, when you're in shape, you can push yourself. Do you know what I mean? Like, when you are not in shape, you just cannot make yourself hurt. You can't get in the pain, in the pain cage.
You can hurt. But the problem is, once you cross that line, there's no coming back.
Yeah.
Where you're in, when you're in good shape, you can just redline it for a long time.
Yeah.
When you're in, when you're in bad shape, as soon as you cross the line,
yeah,
it's just, it's crashed and burned,
yeah,
after that.
Okay. Yeah. I agree with that. It's it was really hard to get into a, in the pain cave. I just couldn't get there. So I think I could carry that on for another few kilometers, maybe 15 kilometers at that pace, maybe. I don't know at the moment. So let's see how we get on and see if we improve over the next few weeks. Get ourselves about, ready for March.
What about the other podcasts? Do you reckon we got them locked down? Or
well, that's a tough one. It's a tough one. I reckon we will do. I reckon we'll do it. I think if we just keep going in our trajectory, we'll be all right. You just need to keep out there.
I'm letting the side down, aren't I?
Well, I'm slightly worried about your week away snowboarding. How are you going to hold on when you get back from that? Yeah.
I'd have to go running in the mornings on the treadmill before.
Yeah, half an hour every day. Get it done. Yeah.
It'd be altitude, so I'll be flying when I get back. You said we've got to do a second 10K to run faster?
Yeah. You'll be smashing.
I'm gonna do that when we get back because I'm gonna have a bit of altitude in my system.
Get the lungs working. Nice. Well, nice. We've had a review, so we need your reviews. The reason we keep asking reviews is it helps us grow the show. So we really want to keep this as a permanent fixture every week. If we can get more listeners and we can reach more people, we will do that. So anything, anytime you can help us a review, particularly on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, if you use that, it's really helpful to us if you can do that. So please send us a review. We will read them out so you can become famous for 5 minutes in your own ears.
And it all depends what your alias name is.
It does,
yeah.
We
might give you
a special prop.
We might big you up or give you some jip.
Do you remember a couple of weeks ago, I should say hello to Minky. So basically, we were saying I thought that Minky Woman was my wife. Playing a joke on me. It's not. I've got a friend who, the producer of the show, Jonathan, he texted me and said, small world, a Milky Wilma lives with my housemate. I think it was he lived with one of his ex-housemates or something, so it's quite interesting. So, hello, Minky. Sorry that we thought you were my wife. thanks for the review. But this one, I read it out. It says, fantastic running podcast. It's by Muggin5. Five stars. The White Devil.
Shanker Man. Mugging Five, you Mugging know. Five. Shanker Man.
Jermaine's fictitious grime artist, the Shanker Man, hangs out with Mugging Five. And Mugging Five says, the White Devil and Camera Kid who present the podcast are great. Thanks, mate. They both know a huge amount about running, training, and also funny, and also really funny. The podcast has great guests, and all of my running podcasts, this is certainly the best one. Mugging Five.
That's what I'm talking about.
Thanks for that.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a competitive
I might carry
world.
A bit extra. I carry a bit extra cash, so when you try and mug me, I'll skip the
cure. I've got quite a funny story about mugging, actually. I don't know if I said that, but
Here we go.
Right, my friend's a fluent French speaker, right? And this, I don't know if this is a bad story or a good story, but he was over in Bristol as a student, right? And this guy comes up to him, and he was an African of French-speaking African, so he might have been from Ivory Coast, somewhere like that, or Senegal. So he immediately realised the guy. I don't know if he put a knife in his when he was at a cash point in the middle of town and said, "Give me your money." And Tom realised that this guy was a French speaker, so he turned round and said in French, "He said, oh, that's not a very good idea. Like, I haven't got a lot of money. You're actually looking in the wrong place to rob students. You're better off going up to Clifton, where there's loads more students with loads of money." And the guy was like, "Oh, okay. Oh, thanks for that. Thanks for the tip." And I left. They left as mates. So yeah, he left. He said, "Thanks for the advice. I'll head up there and rob someone else." So, it's funny.
That's a good politician. If you're a good politician,
he would be. Yeah, good old Tommy. Yeah, so that was good story.
That's a good one.
Yeah. So what we need to do is learn more languages and to beat the muggers at their own game. Talk to them in their own language.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, we should let you get ready. You're back on the buses this afternoon, so we'll let you get back out, and then we'll look forward to speaking next week.
Cool.
Nice one. Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.
All right, see ya. Bye.